At this time, we begin the sick man on landmark. At least I think it's 8 o'clock, Eastern Standard. With K2KEY and the purpose of the TechNet, for all you guys is to educate everyone about what we're doing, how we do it better, why we do it, the politics and the technology of ham radio are the general subject of discussion. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. And the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the day. Do we have any check-in tonight? Please give me your call letters and name. K2RIW.
M2EO, Virginia.
Dick, W8CDO, just wrote now a message for you.
K2RXV, name is Ben.
And 2NYW, Ed.
This is N2KDN, Todd, no contact.
Okay, so far we've got Rich, Andy, Ben, Ed, and Kaj. And except for Kaj, I'm going to assume everybody's with a yes. Anyone else?
WB2CUK.
Good evening, K2KEY.
Okay, that's how we picked up Bill and Mel. Okay. One last call, just in case there's anybody out there. How about that? We got plenty of people. Rich, what's the latest in Whitestone? And how are they treating the ham radio operators in that town?
Hey, Dick, good evening. So are you. And I'm going to try and talk. A little difficult with this polyp. Dick, the amplifier project is just about done. I got the new custom transformer in. Everything is working very very well. Little minor problem. The amplifier uses a step start relay. Basically, they put a 10 ohm resistor in series with the primary and short it out, you know, after it step starts to a soft start. I've had trouble with that relay going bad, and it's bad right now. I bypassed the step start, so it, you know, it doesn't have that inrush protection. My question is, Ameritron makes an external step start. The only problem I can see, and I'm not sure how to get around it, the step start internal on that amplifier is just to the plate supply. Because when you turn it on, there's 2 minute warm-up period to the filament. Then the countdown timer fires one relay, which closes the primary on the plate. And then, you know, the step start relay shorts. Now, if I put a step start unit in the AC line, what do I do with the fact that when you turn it on, there's a 2 minute warm-up period? You see what I'm saying, Dick? K2RIW and 2EO.
Yeah, I think I see the picture, Rich, and I see the problem. You really want to turn on the filament first, wait till the cathode comes up to essentially full temperature before any B-plus is applied to the tube. I've heard people talk about hot spots in a tube. In other words, if the high voltage is present, particularly the screen voltage if it was a tetrode, high voltage if it's a triode, if the high voltage is present, while the filament hasn't come up to full temperature, what emission it does do is doing from only certain regions that have come up to temperature first, because the whole cathode hasn't been evenly heated yet, and that can partially damage those hot spots. That's the belief. How true it is, I'm not positive, but I'm not willing to gamble, because the kind of tube you're talking about there, Rich, is a pretty expensive tube. Therefore, I'm fairly convinced you want to turn on the filament for some given length of time, BE4. High voltage is applied to the tube. Therefore, the filament transformer, he doesn't have any substantial amount of inrush current. Your filament starts off fairly gentle. It's not a great big capacitive input filter network. What happens, as you probably know, you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on the capacitor. So during those periods of time that Con Ed is at peak positive or peak negative voltage, assuming you've got a full wave rectifier, when Con Ed's at peak voltage, and that's the instant you close your circuit to turn on the high voltage transformer, the transformer momentarily sees a dead short. Only the small amount of resistance of the secondary winding and that reflected into the primary winding, plus the small amount of resistance of the primary winding, plus the resistance of the wiring of your house back to the Con Ed transformer, that's the only thing that limits that current. And that current, that inrush current, could easily be hundreds of amperes, in some cases approaching 1,000 amperes. And the problem with that is that the whatever does that final switching of turning on the high voltage transformer with that much inrush current, it will, without a doubt, damage those contacts to some degree. Very similar to if you talk to any qualified electrician, they'll tell you never, never use a circuit breaker as an on-off switch. In an emergency one time, yeah, go for it. But if you have a house that's so poorly wired that you have to go over to the fuse box and turn on a circuit breaker, in order to turn on and turn off a circuit, you're really doing something that's foolish, because there's only a certain number of times that a set of contacts can tolerate an inrush current before they fail, and you really don't want a circuit breaker failing. Well, in your case, you don't want that switch that turns on the high voltage to fail. The 10 ohm inrush resistor with that relay that shorts it out is a very nice approach to that problem. In that case, you've got 10 ohms of series resistance instead of a milliohm, so to speak, so instead of a nearly 1,000 amperes, in your case, there would only be 200 amperes absolute maximum. As bad as it sounds, for one cycle, that's not so bad compared to what it would be like without that. Now, where your inrush relay has failed, what's the nature of the failure of that relay, Rich? I'd be very tempted to put a sturdier relay if you could squeeze it into your box, but an external start circuit where you try and turn on the filament first, external start circuit sounds to me like it's not going to satisfy your problem, and I don't think you want to put that very expensive tube of yours at risk. N2EO, K2LIW.
K2KEY, I give him his answer.
Go ahead, Mel. Let's hear the answer.
Okay. This is K2KEY. In Collins, they have the inrush protection. It's a relay, two sets of contacts on the relay. And across both sets of contacts, they have a 50 ohm 10 watt resistor. That is the limit. That's the limiting system on the primary of the power supply, Dick. They also have, of course, limiting. They have also a delay, also similar idea that protect, in other words, the soft start of the plate supply. But this is the soft start for the filament transformer, basically for the amplifier to begin with, Dick. Set of two sets of contacts on a relay, which is a nice quality relay, the powder and blue steel relay. And like I say, across the contacts, 50 ohm, 10 watt resistors on each set of contacts, Dick, over.
Now, I'm guessing now, after the 50 ohm resistor does its job, at a later time, the relay shorts out that resistor, so you get full voltage to both filaments and full voltage to your high voltage. Is that true, Mel?
Yeah, well, they got other protection built into the plate supply and all, the soft start that also. But, and they got a clever way how they soft start the plate supply. They got taps on the transformer. Believe it or not, the relay goes from the 2600 volt tap when initially comes on, and then the relay, when it closes, jumps it over to the 3300 volt tap. But on the primary, like I say, the whole that primary is basically when first comes on, it's got those 50 ohm resistors, and then they're shorted out by the relay contact. Over.
Yeah, what Rich was describing to us is that the 50 ohm resistors of the Collins system is, in the case of his Ameritron, is a 10 ohm resistor. In his case, he's got a little more steam coming out of his amplifier. It's a full gallon amplifier and beyond. It's probably a hypersil transformer, which is a kind of a transformer with very low internal resistance. Therefore, his inrush current could easily be five times higher than it was with the Collins equipment, and that's probably the reason they use the 10-ohm resistor. So, Rich, when that relay that shorts out your 10-ohm resistor for the soft start function, when that relay fails, what's the nature of the failure of that relay? Have you replaced more than one of them? Is it an expensive part? Does somebody make a sturdier one? I think you want to keep the soft start internal, or maybe wire it on the outside, put it on the outside physically if you want, but wire it internally so it's only affecting the plate transformer as I see it, not the filament transformer. N2EL, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay,
Dick,
K2RIW, N2EL. Yeah. K6DPZ came up with an idea. He said, put it on the back and put it in a small mini box. I might do that. It's a relay with 30 amp contact. The first time it went out, it went out just a wear. What happened now is my own fault. When I hooked up the dual primary transformer, I made a mistake, smoked the resistor, and hit into contact on the relay. Fortunately, the transformer is just fine. I had the amplifier running today, you know, with a hard start. But I guess from what you're saying, we'll just get another relay from the Ameritron. It's just that, it's not that expensive. It's just that the transformer that I've got is about 30% bigger than the original. Everything is very, very tight in there. It's going to be a heck of a job to get in there and fish the relay out and rewire it. Yeah, Dick.
Yeah, I'm, from what I'm sitting here calculating, 30 amps to me is not too small, but it doesn't have a great safety margin to it. Even with that inrush current, 10 ampere, 10 ohm resistor, being there for, we'll say the 50 milliseconds or whatever it is that it takes to pull in the relay. Let me think about that. Each 60 cycle sine wave is 16 milliseconds. If it was a rapid armature moving relay, some of them can move as fast as 20 milliseconds. Some of them can move more slowly, 50 milliseconds, if it's a really bulky one. So you're only getting a little bit more than one cycle up to about three cycles of the sine wave before the relay closes, if I understand correctly. This is on the assumption that when you flip the switch for the plate voltage, that the relay is energized at the same time as the voltage is enabled for the plate. And I guess another thing you got to worry about is that I'm trying to think now, is there a way that somebody could flip that switch rapidly or have the contacts bounce on the main switch that turns on the primary voltage for the high voltage transformer, the plate transformer, with bouncing contacts there possibly give us an aggravated situation? I'd be tempted to go to a relay with more like 45 amperes of a contact resistance for your particular situation now, Rich. Whatever relay was in there for soft start, because you're now running two tubes instead of one tube, and a little bit beefier high voltage and so on, your total current on primary is greater than that slow start relay was designed for. And as such, I'm guessing that's aggravating the situation. I like Al's idea of a external mini box with the relay in it. It's got a lot of merit, and that way you can put in a much sturdier relay. Is there additional time delay on turning on the slow start, Rich, other than the movement time of its coil? I'm going to guess not much, because if you left the 10-ohm resistor in there for very long, unless it's a very high wattage resistor, it's going to get pretty hot. N2EO, K2RIW.
K2KEY, one more time, Dick. I'll give you some info on that.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Now, what they have is not a regular relay. The relay has this, you know, these springs in the back to pull the relay open. However, on the relay contact, like I say, it's not one 10-ohm resistor that they have in the rig. They got two 50-ohm resistors across each set of contacts. There's two sets of contacts. Now, the relay has a, like a spring. In other words, they figured that quick, you know, jogging of the switch, the main power switch, would cause maybe possibly a bounce there. So what they have is like a damping. It's a relay with like springs that are mounted sort of towards where the contacts are. Instead of a second set of springs with like a flexible piece of braid inside of it, Dick. It doesn't look like the common, you know, relay like, you know, you would envision. It's a little different. I think it's specifically made for these type of applications. Go ahead.
Check it off.
W2PNJ.
Mr. PNJ, go ahead.
Is it a double pole relay that has to be replaced? I'm just thinking, if it's a single pole, you can get a double pole in parallel with contact. If each contact rated 30 amps, would that work?
I think it would help a little bit. Unfortunately, unless the relay is extremely accurately made, one set of contacts will always come in connection a millisecond ahead of the other, and therefore this one's going to tolerate the main surge of current. So putting relay contacts in parallel is not a great way to go unless it's some kind of current-sharing resistor system. I guess he could have a 20-ohm resistor to each set of contacts. Would that do it? No, it wouldn't. No, that wouldn't do it either. That's a tough one. If your contacts are not really rated for the service, because you're going to get differential keying of those relay contacts, and that whoever comes in contact first is going to be the one that's going to fail, my recommendation is that he put a sturdier relay, higher current rating, on the outside. And I'm guessing also that they could have designed it with what's called a dash pot. In other words, a kind of a shock absorber, a slowing down circuit, so that you get a few more cycles of the 60-cycle sine wave going into the transformer before you short out, in his case, a 10-ohm resistor. Wonder how many watts is that 10-ohm resistor, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Not much. It's only a 10-ohm, 12-watt resistor. That's what they put in there. As far as jogging of the switch, that's not a problem, because if it gets jogged, it goes into a trickle down where it starts warming the filaments up again for 180 seconds. So I don't believe that's a real problem. It can't go on, off. It'll go on, off, reset, and take another 180 seconds to pull in. The only thing I can think, Dick, I've got some catalogs here, and the relay is made, I read the name right, it says Magnacraft. I'm going to look up, I have a catalog. By the way, I can recommend this company. They bought a lot of parts of them. Allied Electronics, not to be confused with the old Allied Radio. They're based out of Fort Worth, Texas. They're on the internet. I bought the floor from them. I bought a lot of parts for this project from them. And they have no minimum. Yeah, Dick.
I'll give you the number of the relay if you need to, Dick.
Okay, QIQ, we're going to get to you in a second after Mel and after Rich. Yeah, Magnacraft is a good company. Allied, I just recently got a huge catalog from Allied where I bought some parts from them about a year ago on a project I was on. Both Allied, the service company, that the stocking company I'm going to call them, Mauser is another good company, and DigiKey. you combine those three companies, Mouser, DigiKey, and Allied, and I think they all have no minimum. They all have a huge array of parts, high-quality stuff, great catalog, very fair service when it comes to... In fact, I think I bought some things from all three companies because I was buying some pretty wild parts, and some of them had one, and the other one had the other parts, and so on. So I got some good words to say about them. Let's see. Mel first, he's got some further words, and then Mel, and then QIQ in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is KTKTY. Like I say, that's an inrush relay protection system that they have. It's not an ordinary relay. It's a relay that's made by Potter and Bloomfield. The number of the relay, I just looked it up, I pulled the circuit out here. It's a PRD1, Peter Romeo Dog 1. And then it has another number on it, DY0. No, DYO, I guess it is. Dog, Yankee, Hobo. That's the relay. It's SPDT relay. And it has across it that they recommend 50 ohm 10 watt resistance across each set of contacts. And never failed yet. Haven't had any problems. Same final tooth, everything ticks. So must be something they're doing right over.
Yeah, another quick question for you, though, Mel. How many amperes are the contacts rated for on your particular PRD1, DY0, DYO relay? Go ahead.
I don't know the exact rating of the relay, but I'll tell you something. It looks good and hefty. It's a well-made relay. And I can say it's got these extra buffer springs in there. I think those extra buffer springs are so placed as something that... is taking into consideration, like you say, that they both sets of contacts come together at the same time. I think they most likely developed this relay specifically for situations like that where I think contacts are type situations to take over.
So what's your best guess, Mel, as to the price of that particular relay, and had you, if you happen to have bought one?
No, never bought one. The original in there. Most likely, maybe an updated number on it because this goes back a good number of years, this rig. And I don't know, but in all the years, and this thing has been on and off, this thing has been used a heck of a lot. And it's still, everything is still functioning A1 in that, that piece of equipment. So it has to be something that they did right so many years ago, 30 years ago over.
A2B for a suggestion. Okay, Mr. B, you're after Glenn. Glenn, you're next. KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Yeah, just to make a small comment, a lot of times I work in the power supply industry, and to handle sometimes relay contact inrush problems, one of the best devices to put in series with the relay contact is spent welding and excessive wear. An NTC thermal resistor, a company called Amatherm, and they make them up to like 25 amp inrush currents. They'll start up at like 10 ohms, and within a few hundred milliseconds, they wind up down at about half an ohm or so. And it sounds like that would be a nice device here, because this way your inrush current gets dropped across, well, the voltage gets dropped across the NTC, and as it warms up, it basically just comes down to a nice soft resistance, and the relay can recover.
Yeah, that would be a nice way to go. In the early days of series set television sets, where all the filaments were in series, in order to control the inrush resistance, inrush current, which of course one of the filaments is always going to get hotter faster than the other, and you may or may not know that something like a light bulb, for instance, put your ohm meter across a 100 watt light bulb. That 100 watt light bulb, by definition, is drawing a little bit less than 1 ampere, which means it's got something in the vicinity of 130 ohms of resistance when it's hot. Put your ohm meter across the 100 watt light bulb and you'll find out it measures something like 9 or 10 ohms. So therefore the inrush current is not 1 ampere, it's 10 amperes. Things that heat up change a lot in resistance. Filaments are not quite that drastic, but they do. And so filaments of a series string television set, whichever one got hot first, would be sucking up all the voltage, be overheated something fierce, and eventually fail. So to avoid that problem, they used to have this negative thermal resistance thing. They called it a bolometer, a bolo resistor. They called it a bolo resistor on the old Admiral set that Mill and I used to fix back in the dark ages of early television in the late 40s, early 50s. See, I was doing that in the mid-50s. And so that did the job very nicely for the first year or two. But that resistor, of course, being turned on and off five times a day, going through that complete thermal cycle all the time, eventually had a mode of failure where it would never get down to a low enough resistance, so the whole set was running on a partial filament voltage. And as such, you didn't get full performance out of the set that needed a replacement. So things like that would be helpful in this case. Although, in the case of that particular resistor that was used on television sets, the total warm-up time was a good fraction of a minute, whereas Rich would like his warm-up time to be approximately 1 second or so. Rich, if you happen to mail the same set of photographs that you sent to me to Mel, Mel would know what you're talking about. Rich has got a pretty substantial rig there, Mel. As such, I'm pretty sure the inrush current could be considerably greater than it was on your Collins piece of equipment. So therefore, particularly with his modifications, therefore I'm fairly sure he needs a more sturdy relay. I think it was Mr. KA2B, KT2B. Start off with your full call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, hello to everybody on that. Joe, WJ2B, Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo. I just had a quick suggestion for, I'm not sure who the gentleman was with the amplifier project, but I just changed the inrush contactor, incoming voltage contactor on my central AC unit. So for about $10, I think I paid for it, you can get a 40-amp, very high inrush current-rated relay. Probably the only negative to that is it's a 24-volt coil, I believe, on the input. So that's a very easy to get any appliance. I bought it at an appliance repair parts store, refrigerators, air conditioners, that kind of store. So those are very easy to come by, about $10, and you're talking like 40 amps, very heavy duty. Yeah. It would probably work pretty well in a linear. So back over to you, Dick, WJ2B.
That sounds like a nice, inexpensive, very sturdy part, maybe slightly larger, but if he's willing to put it into a mini box, a little doghouse on the back of his rig, that sounds like a great solution. Joe, I see that you live in Wisconsin. A good buddy of mine who's the president of the 10X group, the 10 gigahertz group on Long Island, also lives in Wisconsin, N2LID, Bruce Wood. I wonder if you happen to know him, Joe.
I don't know him personally, but I know his antennas because whenever I go down Southern Boulevard, they stick out off the side of Southern Boulevard. I've noticed them quite a few times. I believe he's like one or two houses off of Southern Boulevard. I think he has two gigantic towers that are probably in the vicinity of 70, 80 feet, something like that.
Your estimation of altitude is right on. And yes, he's the second house in, and I can't think of the name of the street right now, but you would have to easily look him up, and good God, no. You guys should get together. And, okay. So I think, Rich, you've got a number of suggestions there, and I think I would go for the external doghouse. Back to you, Rich, for any final questions, comments, fills. N2EO, K2RX.
ENJ.
Stand by a minute, Rich. Go ahead, Bob.
The PRD series relays is a good series. Tyco Electronics, which is now, I believe, part of Homefield. The electrical supply houses, I'm looking on the website at the picture of the relay, and these are the relays that we buy, and they're relatively inexpensive also in electrical supply house, and they are available with their own enclosure, which makes a nice package.
Okay, excellent suggestion, and I thank you for that one, Bob. Back to you, Rich.
Well, I like the suggestion that thermal, I think you said N-therm, and then the air conditioner relay. I am going to check those out. What I'm going to do is pull out that old magnograph, look up the specs on it. I believe it's 120-volt AC coil, I believe. In the schematic, it says 12 volts, but I think they made a mistake. So I'm going to pull it out. We'll see what the coil says. Hook up the ring light and see where I can go from there. I think for the time being, I may replace it temporarily with the original. Maybe I'll leave it, you know, not mount it, leave it hanging out so I've got some inrush protection, and then do some research and switch over. So thank you very much. Thank you, Ned.
Yeah, this is a common problem, particularly in your case where you put in a sturdier transformer, hypersil transformer, very low internal resistance, more current, more tubes, whatever. You beefed up that rig and therefore you need more of a relay there, as I see it. Good luck with that project. Andy, WA2CDL, what's the latest with you? Machine sounds like it's working rather well these days. You got it, Andy. Okay, maybe Andy got called away. Ben is next. AC2 Lima X-ray Victor. You got it, Ben.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I am a new operator, so my question may seem a little bit stupid, but I don't really know, so I'm asking. I live on a very teeny studio in one-room apartment, and I operate with a dual-bender mobile radio and a mag-mount antenna inside the room. How safe it is if I'm operating at 10 watts? Am I doing any damage to myself and my wife here on this room, or is that okay? Thank you very much, Dick.
Okay, 10 watts and in the room with you, with rare exception, it's as safe as all hell, Ben. There are high-power handy talkies that run 5.5 watts, and that antenna, that rubber duck, can operate a small number of inches away from your head. As long as that antenna radiating the 10 watts is more than, I'm going to pick a number, 1.5 feet, 2 feet from you, it's relatively safe. Every time you double the distance between you and that antenna, the amount of energy from that antenna that hits you goes down by 4 to 1. That's the so-called inverse square law. So a couple of feet from the antenna and you're safe, not to worry. On top of that, you're a guy who speaks pretty briefly, Ben, and you're not one of these guys that really rag shoes for a long time, I'm guessing. because the RF energy that hits a human being, the only effect they have ever been able to measure in 50 years of research on the subject is a thermal effect. In other words, the RF energy that hits your body gets absorbed, depending on what frequency, and it gets turned into heat. And no matter what part of the body you're trying to heat up, it takes 6 minutes to do it. So you're supposed to average the amount of watts for a 6 minute period in order to figure out whether or not what you're doing is safe. And if you're making 2 minute transmissions, you could exceed the specification by almost 3 to 1, if you know what I mean. Just like when you boil a pot of water on the stove, you can't get it up to temperature and boil away the water instantaneously. It takes some time. And the same thing when it comes to heating. And the only part of the human body for adult people, per se, that you really have to worry about is the eyes. In order to get yourself in trouble, you'd have to locate your eye, I'm going to pick a number, 6 inches or 5 inches from the antenna, while you transmit continuously for more than 6 minutes with your eye held open, not blinking. You do that particular combination, and yes, you're at the threshold where possibly you could create some eye injury. That's the most delicate part of a human being. But for where you're a couple of feet or more from it, transmitting less than 6 minutes, you're triply safe as I see it, Ben. You'd have to work real hard at it to get yourself in trouble. KC2LXV, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Sal.
All righty, Ed was the next guy. N2NYW, I think it was. Can't read my own writing here, Ed, but you know who you are. Go right ahead, Ed. Okay.
This is N2NYW, Sheepshead Bay. Now, my question was, I'm running a dual band Kenwood 2510H, and I have about 100 feet of LMR 240 cable with a an AR-270. Thing is, the radio is a mobile radio. It was never in the car, never outside the house. What it is, The 440 side works fine, and the 2-meter side, the only complaint is, lately, it's my meter. You know, in other words, only the strongest signal, like if I, let's say I listen to the, on a public service band, they come in strong, the weather band, I'll get a full signal. I'll get a couple of full signals from repeaters, but like, this one I'm only getting like half signal from this repeater, but it should be a full signal. When I transfer the cable to my monoband Kenwood, I get full signals. So I don't know what's doing that. I'm sure it's not damaged or anything because people hear me. It just has me puzzled. Like, I reset the radio. I put all the memories back in. Okay, after about 3 partial resets, I did that. So it's back to factory specs. So that just has puzzled me. Like, when I'm listening to you with 3 bars on the meter, if I hook it up to the Kenwood, it's full scale. So I'm baffled. Back to you.
Yeah, one of the first things to check is that a number of the Kenwood rigs have a hidden switch, so to speak, on the front panel. I'm looking at mine right now, which says attenuator, ATT, a little bit of a switch on my Kenwood TS711, an old-fashioned rig that I like. And that's a 20 decibel attenuator. And there are occasions when somebody has pressed that button, like I just did, and you can just barely tell that it's pressed in, and there could be 20 dB of attenuation. That's one of the first things to worry about. Occasionally rigs, particularly the IC2AT, which is a handy talkie, the center pin on the BNC connector wasn't built correctly as far as having a strain relief is concerned on the inside of the radio. And so that particular solder contact has broken on me about 3 times before I finally put a piece of braid in there, something that's a lot more flexible so it doesn't keep happening. In my case, the radio would go down to very small sensitivity because the semiconductor, the little wire that goes from the semiconductor to the printed circuit board, was just barely making contact or just a capacitive contact. I would bend the rubber duck back and forth and signals would jump up and down in signal strength. So these are some of the things to look at, whether or not the semiconductor on the inside is making good contact. Is there a mysterious attenuator plugged in? After that, where another rig gives you full-scale deflection and your rig does not, in particular Kenwood 2510, that is a little bit suspicious. The possibility exists that its S-meter is very scotch. I'm kind of doubtful on that one. When in doubt, I think the next thing to do is when Limark has its next ham convention, Andy WA2CDL is there 98% of the time with all of his instrumentation. He can measure the sensitivity of your rig. And if it's got half a microvolt or better of sensitivity, you're in like Flynn. If it has 2 microvolts of sensitivity, which means it's 10 or 20 dB down from where it should be, then at least you know something funny is going on. And people like Andy can help you do the troubleshooting and find out what it is. So you're close enough to the repeater. You should be getting a lot of strong signal from it, as I see it, Ed. And so I guess I've given you a couple of suggestions there that the way you might look into it. Anyone else on frequency want to add any suggestions to Ed, give me your call letters right now. K2LAW in the TechNet. Rich.
Hey, why?
Rich and Mel in that order. Rich, go ahead.
Okay, you know, I used to be in the service business, and I gave it up in 92. But I remember every once in a while I would get a flurry of 2-meter or 440 rig come in with low sensitivity. And after a while I realized I was getting these calls a day or two after a lightning storm. And usually the set in the front end was blown. He'll get good signal strength, rather he'll get quieting from Limark or public service bands or any other strong repeater because of the limiting action of the receiver. But if he goes on to simplex, he'll find the receiver kind of dead. They may be using gas vents in these new rigs now, I don't know. When I gave it up in 92, they were using dual gate MOSFETs, and they pop from lightning static.
Okay, that's a suggestion. Also, I'm guessing the rig has either a pin diode network or a real relay that flips between the bands. And I've seen situations where the relay gets a little bit of dirt or a piece of hair or something inside of it, and it's not making good contact. And that can create a 10 or 20 dB extra of attenuation. The contacts get very close to each other. They got capacitive coupling, but they're not making great direct contact. N2E, K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, okay, again, I was going to ask that the same thing. I guess Rich took the words out of my mouth. Okay, Ed, did it once work well, and then all of a sudden this took place? In other words, suddenly?
Go ahead, Ed.
Now, you know what happened? I had it on one day, not too long ago. It was working well, but not as well as the monoband Kenwood, okay? I know meters are different. Now, the 440 side of this is excellent. It's unbelievable. One day I had this on, about 3 months ago, and I always shut my gear when it rains. I even have on a two-way switch. If you put it in the middle, it'll ground it. I just pulled the, shut the amp off and everything. Across the street, I'm on Knapp Street, there's a school. We had a lightning storm, and I had this on, and a bolt of lightning crashed right in the schoolyard. That's maybe about 200, 300 feet away, because I heard the noise, loud, and this was on. This radio. So I thought that might have did it. I don't know. But then after that, it seemed to get a little quirky. Like I said, I reset everything. And I know with the attenuator, you have to put the squelch halfway up. And then the squelch comes on, and it resets it when you shut the radio on and off. But I brought the squelch down. It's not even up near halfway. So I can hear, but I just don't have a signal. Like, you people I hear, fine. You're giving me about a half scale, which some months back it was full scale. Now, with the weaker repeaters, I don't get any signal, but people still hear me good, you know, like the 895 repeater. And the only other repeater that comes in full signal is that Manhattan one, the 4700, and that 47360. The other ones, nah, like the 146730, that's not far from me. That comes in like quarter scale, and they say they hear me good with it, but I hear them low sometimes, you know, I don't get much on them. This one I'm getting is half scale, but like there's some repeaters that are at a rate, you know, far away, forget about it. They say they could hear me, but I'm not hearing them too well. Over.
Yeah, I'm hearing enough symptoms to tell me that with that lightning strike across the street, you may have suffered some damage only on 2 meters. That's where it was tuned at the time, we'll say. And so I think it's time for Andy to make a measurement of how many microvolts is the sensitivity of your rig. And if it's half a microvolt or a quarter of a microvolt and better, it's flying like a charm. Maybe it's just got a very Scotch S-meter. Although you're not hearing things that can hear you. It makes it sound like you're an alligator instead of a rabbit, if you know what that means. You're transmitting better than you're receiving. So I think it's time to do a check, Ed. And after you do find out what's going on, please come back and let us know. Because I guarantee there are other guys with a Kenwood 2510 would like to know what you discover. Good luck with that project. I think we've gone down the list. Let's see if I... Oh, let's see. Bill? Yeah, hold on now. Bill, WB2CUK. Can't keep him waiting. He's the guy who supplies us all that equipment. Bill, go right ahead.
W2BIE, what's a 2510? I used to sell old Kenwoods at Barry. They never had a model 2510 Kenwood.
I see ICOM 2510. My other radio was a Kenwood 261. And when I switch over, the Kenwood has, they get full scale on most of its frequencies. And this one, I get like a half scale on this repeater. And a couple of strong ones on closer repeaters, but distant repeaters, like I said, they hear me, but I have a hard time hearing them. I don't even get a signal on them.
You mean a 2710?
Yeah, Roger, 2710H.
Okay. Back to net, W2BIE. Good evening.
Sorry about that. I think I wrote down the wrong model numbers and the wrong brand names there. Bill, WB2CUK? Go right ahead with your question or comment, sir.
Yeah, before I go, are you copying me all right?
Just a tiny bit of noise, but you're copying very well, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay, for everyone's interest, I'm using a radio that's older than probably a lot of the club members, an FM-27B, a Clegg, which I picked up today at the Antique Wireless Association. Now, I was listening to Rich's problem with the inrush current on the relay, and if he has constant voltage going to that unit where we can get a little power supply and a circuit together, why not use a zero crossing detector to fire that relay at the zero crossing point? Now, of course, you have mechanical delays of the relay moving, so maybe have it count, say, two or three zero crossings and then fire the relay. So I was thinking something exotic like that, but I think one fellow mentioned the baristas, which is a pretty good idea. And that's about all. I'm checking radios out tonight, and if you're copying me on this, then that means you have no PO running on the repeater, and this radio is working fine. And I think the fellow with the receive valve may have a blown fed in his front end, which any probably could take care of. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Bill. Yeah, that FM-27B, I remember that Clegg rig. I think that's the one where you have some continuous knobs that allow you to tune to the exact frequency you're listening to on the repeater. Is that true?
Yes, there are click knobs for the 100 kilohertz, so, the 100 kilohertz, and then for the 10 kilohertz, it's a variable. And you have a spot key where you can actually spot the input, because the scale on the knobs is not exact. And I have two of them here. The other one is the one I first called in on, and you did hear me, and this is the second one. It's a little radio looking, but what's typical about these radios, Dick, it's really funny. Everyone I've seen, the meter does not stay in the slot. I think they use tape on it, and of course after 30 years or so, the tape dries up. So my solution is to use some hot melt around the edge of the meter inside the radio. So these are little project radios before I put them up for sale, but that's about it, Dick. I'm going to take off the wipeless client for me, so I got to give her a little attention. This is not my radio night. Thursday night at 8:30 is my radio night. 73, Dick, at WBTCUK. We'll be clear.
One last question, Bill. How many watts output on an FM-27D? Is it more than 10 watts?
I'm taking about 3.5 amps off my supply, and I think they put out 25. I think they're rated at 25.
Very good. Okay, we got a confirmation on that. Thank you, Bill. And Rich, 25 watts. Okay, I think Bob was an expert in new signs, W2PNJ, either because he made a comment or I put him on the list of somebody who signed it. Bob, you're gonna have a question for us. Go right ahead.
W2IGH.
W2IGH, go right ahead.
Hello, good evening to you, Dick. This is Hugo in Sayas. I have two questions for you. I meet with some people, some amateurs, about twice a week. We meet for lunch at various times. And your program came up, I kept mentioning, and there were some of them who wanted to know that there is a website that shows past talk. In other words, somebody's copying your presentations every week, and they wanted to know what the website is. There is a website, I even looked at it, that shows all these past talks that you're giving, you know, the TechNet talks that you're giving on Sunday. So I would appreciate if you could give me that again. I forgot the name of it. That's one of the things. The other thing I wanted to mention, I heard, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, when you discussed dipoles. And I tell you, I put up a G5RE. And now my area where I can put it up was not big enough, so I cut it to a junior. You know, I had a full size that I had lying around, and I put it up, and then but it was too long, so I had to cut it down, and I cut it down to a junior size. You know, I measured it to the junior length. And I put it on, you know, and I could actually get an SWR, almost one-to-one SWR, on most of the bands with an external tuner. And but I didn't get out very well. I mean, I could get out on 20 meters, but I couldn't get out on 80 meters. So I decided to lengthen it and make it a full size again. You know, I put whatever I cut off, I put back on there. And but however, I also raised one leg by about, oh, maybe about 4 or 5 feet, 6 feet, maybe. And I put it, I found a tree that I could put it on and so forth. And that made a tremendous difference. In other words, it was almost like night and day. Now I have that one up and I get foreign station, you know, Europeans and everything, and I get beautiful reports. So I'm just wondering, you mentioned that, I think it was, according to what you said, it was probably the increase in height, but I only increased one leg. And I kept the twin lead that feeds it at the same length, but it made a tremendous amount of difference in the our communication, you know, the ability to communicate. Just wanted to tell you that and see what you're saying about that. So back to you, Dick.
Hugo, and a quick question. How many feet of twin lead and what kind of twin lead? Is it 600 ohm transmitting line, or is it a 72 ohm zip cord, or is it a 300 ohm television twin lead? How many feet and what kind of twin lead are you using on that dipole, Hugo? Go ahead.
I think it's the one they supply, which is a 400 ohm ladder line type. A ladder line, really. I shouldn't have said twin lead, but it's a ladder line. That comes with the, that they feed with the G5RV. But I did cut it off when I cut the length, you know, and I left it that way. So it's a little short, and I think they say it should be about 30 feet, but I left it at around 15 or so. But it works out wonderfully anyway. Then it goes into the co-op.
Yeah, Dick, they got it also that now would have to be changed if you change the length of the 450 ohm line, Dick.
Well, that's if you wanted to have a reasonably good standing wave ratio. If Hugo is using a pretty good antenna tuner and 450 ohm ladder line is reasonably low at law, particularly at 80 meters, except for the altitude change, even if his antenna, before he changed the altitude, if the antenna was a little bit too short and therefore capacitive, and if his antenna tuner can handle it, I would have thought the insertion loss of the 450 ohm ladder line would be low enough that that whole system should work with reasonable efficiency for that altitude. You may have some opinions on that one, Mel. K2RIW?
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. All right, we're about G5RV. The commercial ones that most likely he bought, as he said, came with the line. The line is a specific length, and then is a transformer-type device that they give you, a balun-type transformer device that your coax that screws onto it. It's potted. Usually it's a potted device, you know, weather sealed and all. If you're going to alter the length of the antenna and the feed line, the 450 ohm feed line, you have to change that balancing device. That you just can't, you know, alter that antenna, you know, to suit yourself without making other changes over time.
Yeah, for those who have not become familiar with the G5RV, the Lou Varney antenna, he's a silent key now, but a fairly smart British amateur who invented this antenna a couple of decades ago. It is an interesting mixture of open wire line and coax cable and balun, which covers multiple bands with rather good visuar everywhere, except some people complain that the standing wave ratio is kind of high on 10 meters. But sounds to me like Hugo did make some changes to fit his particular environment. Under normal circumstances, an ordinary dipole, you talk to the average guy about an 80-meter dipole, which is around 131 feet long, and if you started making it one-half, one-quarter, or one-eighth of that length, because the antenna is much, much smaller in physical size, every amateur believes the antenna will be much smaller in effective capture area, and therefore the gain will be decreased. Good common sense. And believe it or not, that's not the way dipoles work. As I've been saying for some time, infinitesimal dipoles, you make a dipole smaller and smaller, and if you're smart enough to still impedance match it with a good antenna tuner and a very low loss feed line, you'll only lose 4/10 of a dB when you go from full half-wave dipole down to something that's much, much smaller. The magic of resonance makes that happen. When you make it much smaller, it becomes very narrowband. You QSY 100 KC and you got to retune everything. It becomes a narrowband antenna. But game-wise, it's the same. It's a hard one to believe, I know. But the extra altitude on 80 feet is every bit help. Because until your antenna gets a quarter wave or so above the ground, because the ground reflection makes the pattern of the antenna change, elevation pattern, and for less than a quarter wave, the majority of your energy is going straight up. It's called a NVIS antenna, N-V-I-S, near vertical incident sky wave. And so it's a great way to talk to somebody very, very close. But for real DX, it needs some altitude when you're using horizontally polarized antennas. And if you had enough of a tower or a very tall tree around where you could set up a vertical dipole, full halfway vertical, that would be one hell of a DX antenna. You're going to have to grow a very strong pine tree or whatever on your property there, Hugo, or get one of these steel pine trees made by the Rhone Company. Maybe a crank-up version. I think you see where I'm going. Now, when it comes to listening to Fast TechNet, it's a little bit of an unusual website. It's not .org or .net or whatever. It's amateurradio.tv. You spell that out, www.amateurradio. There's a double R between those two words. No punctuation between them. Amateurradio.tv. You go to that website, and you can listen to a large number of past recordings of Mel and I waxing away on our opinions on ham radio, as well as the technical net that's on Thursday night from the Barra organization in New Jersey. They also have a tech net. So you can, Warren runs that one, I think it is. And so there's some great tech nets out there. what this guy has done, it's a real labor of love. He has documented, you could say, every 5 minutes of what's on the TechNet. A very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, Kilo Charlie 2, November Juliet India. He takes these hours and hours and hours of Mel and Dick and all of our friends talking, and every 5 minutes he says what the subject is, and you go to the TechNet, you'll look down that list of subjects, and you'll find out your favorite subject is on reel number 3 that occurred last Sunday, and you go to that reel, and back comes an hour's worth of material. It is compressed audio, not completely hi-fi, but rather understandable. If you want that information, it's there. So maybe that's some of the information you're looking for there, Hugo. Glad you added some extra altitude to your antenna. And if you added a little bit more altitude, boy, you'd be a TX station. You'd be creating pileups there, Hugo. W2IGH, HURIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Very fine. Thank you very much for that website that you told me there, amateurradio.tv. In fact, I looked at this one time when you mentioned it. You mentioned it on the air, and I looked at it, and I saw it, and I saw all the listings on there. So, but the talk came up. We talk about it when we get together with my colleagues there, you know, fellow amateurs, and some of them wanted to know, you know, if they could listen to, they would like to know. I mentioned that there was a website that has this, but I didn't remember what it was, so I mentioned, and they wanted to know that, so now I get them, and I get together with them, I can tell them where to look, because they said they were knowledgeable about your TechNet, but they didn't know about the that somebody had recorded it. And I mentioned that, but I couldn't give them the website. And as to the other, the G5 RE, yeah, that was the one I couldn't get. I had some friends even in the area here. Great Deck, for example, we get together on the Sunday net. and they couldn't hear me when the short dipole and the height. So I raised that height on the one leg, and it made a big difference because now they could all hear me and so forth. And I even can join the net.